The connection between art and alcohol is legendary. In Jeannie Darst's memoir, Fiction Ruined My Family, she writes about what happens when that world collides with family life. Jeannie Darst joined me in our New York studio. Her story begins with her family picking up and moving east in order to fulfill her father's writing ambitions.
We were moving from St. Louis to Amagansett to a place called Stony Hill Farm so that my dad could get his novel together. He had started it, but he really wanted to take a year to write this novel in a place where, you know, he could just focus on that. He wasn't going to have a job. Also, he wanted to be in a more literary community around more writers and write in peace and quiet.
Did that end up happening?
You know, he never passed up going to the beach. They did a lot of cocktail parties and socializing, and he did get the novel together, and he did finish it and get it out to publishers. It was not bought. And then at that point, my mom sort of said, all right, this adventure is over. You need to get a job. For her, it was sort of like, you know, let's get back to being fancy. Let's move to a very expensive town in Westchester, Bronxville, New York, and buy a 5-bedroom house that we can barely afford, and you're going to get a job, and I'm going to go back to using the good silverware. And, you know, because we were, you know, when we moved to Amagansett, we were living on Stony Hill Farm in a reconverted barn. It was very romantic. The house next door was called the Hill House. It was where Marilyn Monroe and Arthur Miller spent their summer of 1957. There were lots of writers around. But my mom was sort of ready for that to be over and to resume her life, which was one of great privilege.
I found that very interesting that, I mean, your parents, you describe both of them, their background of, like you said, having some degree of wealth.
They were not Rockefellers. They were not Hearsts. But for me, when I watched what happened to our family, it just became this question in my mind, and that's the question that I was setting out to discover writing this book. How does this happen to people like this? How do people lose their way? How do people lose their will to live, in my mother's case, and their bearings?
Your mother had an alcohol problem, and I guess your dad did too, technically. It was sort of hard to tell in the book how you felt about it. And I couldn't tell when you realized that they had a problem and that it wasn't just them being glamorous social butterflies.
People say, like, when did you realize that drinking was a problem? And I think the answer to that is around midnight, you know. Because when they started off and my mom was making these insane 4-course meals, she was just a really great cook and it was a lot of fun. There was, you know, La Traviata on the hi-fi and they were dancing and everything was great. And of course, it was 10 o'clock by the time we actually had dinner. So we'd already had 2 or 3 bowls of cereal just to sort of last until dinner, you know, when you're in sixth grade, you know. But then, you know, I would see the dark side of that, which was then, you know, wine bottles being thrown and accusations. And so I always knew, maybe unlike other kids, that drinking had a few sides to it.
Over the course of the book, you also talk about you being on a similar path in terms of beginning to do really abusive drinking. Mm. And when did you kind of realize that, as you described, the genome was on the wall?
The genome was on the wall. I mean, the first time I drank, and my mom was drinking a lot at that point, I didn't know, like, oh, I'm an alcoholic.
And how old are you at this point?
Oh, I'm like 14. Yeah. And I blacked out. And, you know, I knew, like, oh, I have that thing too. And so the question is, how do I get away with it? How do I get away with it? I could always see what was down the road. And in that way, my mom's alcoholism was, I'm not going to say it was a blessing or anything, but it was something that helped me. Because unlike other people who maybe didn't know about alcoholism, I knew about alcoholism, you know. So I think that I was able to see where it was going for me.
And yet you headed down that path for a bunch of years.
Yeah. Yeah. And I sort of say in the book that for a long time I was worried about becoming my mother. And then I was worried about becoming my father. And then I was worried about becoming myself. And what that means is that I was both of them. Everybody looks at their parents and says, how do I do it better? How do I do it differently? Right. But if you want to do something differently, usually make completely different choices. So I said, how am I going to be like my parents? By doing the exact same thing they did, becoming a writer, you know. becoming an alcoholic.
In the end, do you think that you were able to untangle the idea that struggling artists have painful lives and abuse alcohol? And it seemed like those lifestyles to you were linked for a very long time.
Yes. And I still do link them in ways that, you know, I sort of think like, oh, here I am in my comfortable chair. You know, you can't write anything in a comfortable chair. You have to be sitting on a rock, starving. So,
and being productive sober.
Yeah. But, you know, I got sober in Brooklyn and I realized like half these people in Brooklyn here putting out these books are sober. And so something new emerged for me, some new concept, saw other people who were not going downhill, who were creating things. And I just sort of forged this new idea for myself of what a writer could do and be.
Jeannie Darst is the author of the new memoir, Fiction Ruined My Family. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thanks for having me, Audie.
The movie Moneyball is just one new film based on a true story. That one is about baseball's Oakland Athletics. This weekend, an even more ambitious Hollywood film opens about the competitive sport of birdwatching. And Mark Uricki of member station WKSU reports that the real story behind it is just as improbable as making a studio comedy about the thrills of spotting birds.
Director David Frankel had just made The Devil Wears Prada and was about to start filming Marley and Me when he was pitched the idea of a movie on bird watching. His reply was, ow.
That was my first reaction. Of course, that was the studio's first reaction. There's a lot of, you know, downcast eyes and sideways glances and, you know, eyebrows shooting up.
The pitch was based on the 2004 nonfiction book The Big Year. It followed three men who set out to find the greatest number of bird species in North America for the calendar year 1998. In birding circles, that's called doing a big year. Many birders have a goal of spotting 700 species in their lifetimes. These guys were each trying to find 700 in one year. One of them was Greg Miller. Was he surprised when he heard Hollywood was turning his story into a movie?
Yeah.
Miller grew up a Mennonite in the Amish country of Ohio. He started bird watching with his father when he was just a preschooler. In the late 90s, he wasn't planning a big year because he was working a full-time job as a computer coder, working to eliminate Y2K bugs. But then he received his final divorce papers on December 31st, 1997.
In 1998, I decided, I'm an emotional guy, so rather than wallowing around in self-pity, I would go bird watching to keep myself distracted because it's something that totally takes me away. I walk into a woods and my regular life just fades away.
The two other real-life birders portrayed in the movie were both born in the Bronx. Both were well-off, retired businessmen. At first, Miller didn't know that others were also out to set the record that year.
By May, I found out about another guy who was probably doing a big year but never admitted it. And then it was midsummer when I found out about the second guy. And both those guys, Al Levinton and Sandy Comito, had done terrifically well, and I realized I had serious competition that year.
In the film, the characters based on Levinton and Comito are played by Steve Martin and Owen Wilson.
You ever get the feeling you're being followed?
Hello, Master.
How you doing, Stu? Still filling those weekends, I see. Unless you and your son here are doing a big year.
Kenny Bostick, this is my friend, Brad Harris, who's also not doing a big year.
Bigfooted Goose! Bigfooted Goose, other end of the boardwalk!
Both of them are wealthy, and both of them had the whole year, and there was me literally working on my contract to pay for my next trip, maxing out 5 credit cards, borrowing from my parents, scraping to make ends meet, doing things on the cheap.
Greg Miller is a man who probably gets more hugs per mile than any man I've ever met.
Mark O'Masick is the author of the book, The Big Year. He says the lovable roly-poly Miller spent days in the Dakotas living off nothing but a jar of peanut butter and a bag of pretzels. But all three men had to rush all over the continent whenever someone spotted a rare bird.
These guys talk about how they would fly from Baltimore, you know, all the way to Southern California with hopes of seeing a gull. And the longest part of that trip is the rush from the car out to where the bird is being seen. You don't want to fly thousands of miles and spend hundreds of dollars to be able to see a bird, only to have it leave just as you arrive. Every hardcore birder has got a horror story about that sort of story.
Stuck off, headed north, probably be in Iceland by Friday. Boy, she was a beaut, too. Hey, is that a calliope?
Nah.
Sorry to disappoint you, boys.
again.
To get more than the 675 native birds to North America, the men went to well-known spots where storms would blow in non-native species called vagrants. One so-called bird funnel is in Alaska. In fact, Miller and Sandy Comito ended up at the same time on Attu, the westernmost Aleutian island, where a big storm is always blowing in.
You're in a very remote place. We had 70-mile-an-hour winds blow in from the west, from Asia, for 3 days in a row. And it started raining birds out of the sky, so there were olive-backed pipits falling out of the sky.
There's going to be major fallout in a few hours.
Nuclear fallout?
Bird fallout.
Some of the more rare species that we saw there included oriental greenfinch. There was a great knot, which was the first for that island, and a good record.
Greg Miller saw 212 species in one day. Despite the competition and some gaming among the three, author Marco Masek says the birders did help each other. And what's more remarkable, their lists are tabulated strictly on the honor system.
I mean, at one point, Al Levinson told me, he said, you know, in a big year, there's no trophy, there's no cash prize, there's no parade. Why do you do a big year? If you cheat in a big year, who are you cheating?
In the end, all three men recorded more than 700 species that year. Birders now believe the combination of unusual weather patterns and the easier air travel of the day make for a record that will never be broken. For NPR News, I'm Mark Uricchi in Akron.
Huge crowds marched yesterday against a number of social concerns gripping the country. Healthcare, corporate greed, unemployment. Solidarity demonstrations linked to the Occupy Wall Street movement took to the streets from New York to San Francisco. In Boston, protesters were supported by a different kind of observance. Reporter Ari Daniel Shapiro was there Friday night and has this report.
So we're downtown Boston. It's raining. And Dewey Square, this is the site of Occupy Boston.
That's right. Yeah. Right across the street here is the encampment.
Leah Madsen is bundled into a red raincoat. She leads me past rows of evenly spaced tents. We reach the corner, and Madsen points to the reason she's brought me here. A 9-foot-tall rectangular hut with colorful fabric walls and a roof made of branches stands on the grassy corner.
It might be a little muddy over here.
This is a sukkah, a structure built for the Jewish harvest holiday of Sukkot.
Back in biblical times, Israelites would celebrate the end of the harvest out in the fields in these temporary huts. And today we still build a sukkah. You're supposed to eat in it, you're supposed to sleep in it, you're really supposed to dwell in the sukkah.
Madsen is an organizer with the Workman's Circle, a center for Jewish culture, and one of numerous groups that helped coordinate the festivities here. Sukkot celebrates abundance and harvest, but it's also about the vulnerability of being inside a hut open to the elements. Madsen sees these themes echoed in the Occupy movement, an abundance of creativity and passion, and the vulnerability of those with fewer resources.
Hi, everybody.
It's the start of Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath. Jocelyn Berger stands in the sukkah, leading services for the 20 people who've gathered nearby.
Okay, Lechuna Ranana. This invites us to sing to God. I would like to add, let's sing to Occupy Boston.
Over the next half hour, the crowd grows to about 50, and the rain lets up. At the edge of the group, I find a couple onlookers.
I'm Vladimir Albin Jr. One of the songs that they were singing, they were talking about like how they're all friends and they're happy to be here, and I was just like, oh, wow, this is pretty cool.
Boston's one of several cities across the country with sukkahs at the Occupy protests. Annie Fox is with the Jewish Alliance for Law and Social Action. For her, both the Occupy movement and the holiday of Sukkot are reminders of our fragility.
We remind ourselves of the people who are homeless, of the people who are struggling, of the people who are facing unemployment. We remind ourselves of the struggle of the past and the struggle of the present.
Near the end of the service, the group sings the Shehecheyanu, a blessing that celebrates doing something for the first time. It's this group's first time gathering at this sukkah to celebrate Shabbat. The rain starts up again, the colorful umbrellas pop open, and everyone keeps on singing. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel Shapiro.
This is NPR News. The Fox News Channel recently celebrated its 15th anniversary. It was a welcome bit of good news for Rupert Murdoch, the media titan behind its parent company, News Corp. Murdoch is still ducking the fallout from a summer-long scandal with his newspapers on the other side of the pond. First, the News of the World newspaper closed down after outrage over phone hacking by its reporters. Now the top executive of the Wall Street Journal Europe has resigned over accusations that the paper was involved in a scheme to inflate its circulation numbers. On Sundays, we often check in with NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik for stories like this and more. And David, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Audie.
So a lot of moving parts to this story, but it sounds like Murdoch and company are probably due for a news tip.
I would think so. I think today's news tip is that it's tough for a news company, a media organization, to restore credibility after it's been pretty badly damaged.
Well, how does this latest scandal about inflating circulation numbers at Wall Street Journal Europe fit into the kind of summer-long scandals that we've been hearing about?
Well, it fits in a couple of ways. A key one is this. I mean, the scandal was about the inflation of circulation levels to the point where it's got to be pretty clear now to advertisers that they've been paying for a lot more circulation than they've actually been getting. But the second part of it is that it turns out that the publisher who said he was resigned this past week, Andrew Lankoff, had promised one of the firms involved in this kind of three-card Monty arrangement favorable editorial coverage. That's a no-no. That's a clear breach of Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal's ethics as well as journalistic standards. And it came as a real shock, I think, to journalists both inside and outside the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal.
At this point, why is this worth watching in the larger media world and for us here in the States?
Well, this has been a season of woe for News Corp. If you look at the question of its credibility and its integrity, it's come under extreme assault in the last few months. News Corp was required in its British arm to shut down one of its top tabloids there, the News of the World, because of its central role in the phone hacking and police corruption scandal there. News Corp was forced to abandon its plan to take over all of BSkyB, the largest broadcaster in the UK. And it's lost a number of the top executives, including some of the people closest to Rupert Murdoch. Time and time again, after allegation have proven to have substance to him, the company has been forced to retreat and acknowledge some of its wrongdoing.
Now I'm even reading that they've been advising the shareholders, some outside advisors have advised that Rupert Murdoch and his son should be kicked off the board of their own company.
Given the structure of the company, that seems quite unlikely to happen. There's an annual meeting of shareholders due to take place this coming Friday in Los Angeles. And yet Rupert Murdoch on his own controls roughly 40% of the voting shares of News Corp. He's a strong ally in a Saudi prince who controls another 6-7%. So right there between them, they're going to have enough to be able to hold off any strong shareholder challenges. But that said, you know, there does seem to be roiling discontent with the idea of the way in which the company has been managed, even as, over time, it is indisputable that Rupert Murdoch and his executives have led that company to a lot of financial success. And, you know, their investors are pretty happy to keep supporting that as long as the profits keep coming in.
But, David, all kinds of news organizations suffer challenges to their credibility. I mean, of course, New York Times and Jason Blair and here at NPR. I mean, why is this any different?
Well, news organizations are inherently human endeavors, right? So there are going to be missteps and there are going to be challenges to the credibility of news reporting and of corporate actions. The question for a news organization is not, are you perfect? The question is, how do you deal with it? And a key value these days is transparency, sharing with listeners and viewers and readers what you know. I think in this case, you can say in recent months, News Corp has tended to come out swinging, attacking its critics, whether The Guardian and The New York Times, particularly in the hacking scandal, or here with The Guardian once again in raising questions about this circulation agreement. I think that the problem is so many times News Corp's British arm, News International, has been forced to retreat again and again that the credibility, giving the Wall Street Journal Europe and News Corp the benefit of the doubt in this instance, becomes much tougher. So that leads us once more to today's news tip, and that's that for a news organization, it's a lot harder to restore credibility once it's been badly damaged.
NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You bet.
And if you've got a news tip for us, please share. Go to our website, npr.org/thenewstip, all one word. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
When the United States took control of the Philippines at the turn of the 19th century, one of the first goals was to send in American teachers to establish a public school system and turn the Philippines into an English-speaking country. It worked so well that two centuries later, American schools started traveling to the Philippines to recruit teachers to come here.
It's a big move for you all, and you're going to be faced with a new culture. And as much as you may think that you know about America and about American culture, it's going to be foreign to you.
That's a scene from a documentary called The Learning by Ramona Diaz. The film follows four teachers on their journey from the Philippines to classrooms in Baltimore, Maryland. Last year, about 600 Baltimore teachers were Filipino. This summer, in a nearby Maryland county, foreign-born teachers got caught up in a visa dispute between the schools and the Department of Labor. It could force hundreds of teachers to leave the U.S. by the end of the year. And as unemployment and budget pressures have risen, foreign recruiting has stalled. But Ramona Diaz says just a couple of years ago, there was a rush to the Philippines.
At the height of the recruitment, which was in 05, 06, 07, they were recruiting from overseas because there was a shortage of math and science and special ed teachers.
When the Baltimore recruiters allowed you access to come with them to the Philippines for them to make their pitch, what did they say? What was the recruiting like?
It was a lot of people. They interviewed more than 400 teachers.
Wow,
in two different
cities.
How many
spaces?
I think they recruited 100. So that was only one trip. You know, they just kept going back to the Philippines.
Ramona Diaz, your film, The Learning, profiles four women who come to Baltimore. One of the women profiled in the film, Grace Amper, is also here with us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
When the Baltimore recruiters came, what was it that made you go listen?
I have to admit it. The salary there is very low. It's just like $300 a month. And teaching here, I will really get a lot. And I can prepare a better future for my son. I had a 3-month-old son when the interview was done there in the Philippines.
My tito will take care of me for a year.
Ultimately, you did come. How was that first year?
I was just a little shocked with the culture. Back in the Philippines, teachers were treated like gods and goddesses, and students will keep their mouth shut, and they don't make scenes inside the classroom.
I imagine that must have been hard. You're walking into new classrooms, a new city. It's a new, pretty harsh culture. And there's a scene in the documentary where one of your fellow teachers is trying to deal with unruly kids.
Again? Why you look mean?
Because you're noisy.
No!
And you're not normal.
Agree, my observation right here!
During my first days, students would say, "What are you talking about? Why are you doing this?" It was a little shock for me.
And your family was able to come join you after the first year?
Yes, after the first trip, but not after my son rejecting me for 1 month.
There's a hard scene in the documentary where he, mm-hmm. you've just come home, and he won't look at you. He prefers his auntie.
You look at mommy, baby. Look at mommy. Look at mommy, baby.
Grace, did you ever consider hanging it up and going home?
During my first year, yeah, first few weeks, but after that, life here is easier. Yeah, and my family's here. I gave birth to another son 3 years ago, and they're all here, so I'm happy here. I don't want to leave.
Grace, did you come over on a temporary visa?
I came in on a J visa, that's a teacher exchange. It was good for us because after 3 years, we changed it to the working visa, and we have a cap of 6 years. So I can stay here for 9 years. So now I have 4 years left. If I decide to go home after 4 years, I can. But if I want to stay here and really look for a district who will sponsor me for a permanent residency visa, then I have to go to another district to be sure.
Grace Amper is a native of the Philippines and a math teacher at Baltimore's Polytechnic School. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ramona Diaz is an independent filmmaker. Her documentary, The Learning, is available streaming on PBS's POV website until October 20th. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News.
It's the kind of event amateur astronomers dream of. One of the brightest supernovas in the last century is now visible. As Daniel Hajek reports, Supernova 2011 FE is bringing out the stargazers.
Saturday night in the desert town of Yucca Valley, California, 2 hours east of Los Angeles, far away from the big city lights. The town's community center parking lot is buzzing with a group of excited backyard astronomers like Carolina Lichtenstein.
I spend hours every night with my dog and maybe some popcorn and just look at the stars. I haven't turned on my TV lately. I get goosebumps.
Lichtenstein's guides for tonight's stargazing are two professional astronomers, Paul McCudden and Dean Arvidson, who set up three highly sensitive cameras that look like giant telescopes. They're projecting the images onto a large screen.
Tighten up the focus a little.
Very nice.
By day, they teach courses in physics and astronomy at Los Angeles City College. But tonight, Arvidson and McCudden take to the mic and play tour guides of deep space.
This is probably, you know, a few billion stars right there. Yeah. And then that one single star can be as bright as a few billion stars.
This supernova is just above the Big Dipper. It's a type 1A, meaning it formed from a thermonuclear explosion of a white dwarf star.
There we go. We're starting to get an image. The spiral arms of 101.
That's Messier 101, the pinwheel galaxy. And within that galaxy, McCudden points to a faint speck of light, the supernova. The crowd leans towards the screen.
This is pretty rare. You don't see supernovas this bright very often.
This is the fifth brightest supernova in the last 110 years.
That's Dr. Peter Nugent from Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He was looking at that same galaxy this past August when he discovered the supernova, just hours after light from the explosion reached Earth. One like this has never been caught that young. And Nugent says, astronomically speaking, it's really close.
The supernova is only located 21 million light years away. We have had only about a half a dozen type 1A supernova in the past century that have been as close.
So it's a pretty special moment for the people standing out here in Yucca Valley, like Crescencio Garcinella from Landers, California. Seeing it makes him feel like an explorer himself.
Like Christopher Columbus, you know, just gaze and wonder how gigantic this universe is and we're part of this.
Supernova 2011 FE will last for more than a decade, but it won't stay this bright. Within the next week, the light that took 21 million years to reach Earth will fade out of view for amateur astronomers. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Hajek.
This is NPR News.